Okay, so if we could make, I've just been asked to introduce this this meeting this evening in place of Nick McGoran. So I'm Matthew Reck, I'm a teaching fellow here in political geography and part of the Power Space Politics Cluster here at the university. And so just before I go in to introduce the meeting itself, just something about the two groups that are co-sponsoring this event. So first, this meeting is co-sponsored by Northeast Stop the War. And as probably most of you know, Stop the War Coalition has since 2001 been dedicated to the ending of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, to bringing troops home, to exposing and enforcing change in British foreign policy. And through campaigns and other activism, it also opposes sanctions and military action toward on Iran, supports Palestinian rights, more broadly opposes racism and upholds civil liberties. Now, so the other half of the sponsors, Power Space and Politics Cluster. So this is PSP is a grouping of political development and military geographers who explore the expression of power across space. And so we have people who study international boundaries, a range of issues from geopolitics, international development, militarism, but also the politics of resistance, justice and peace. And so it's in that context that this evening's talk is entitled The New Scramble for Africa, and I think this is highly topical considering recent news. And I think it's an opportunity to seek complementarity between the two co-sponsors and to think about the shared interests of these groups. So with that, I can introduce the talk. So Dr. Hakim Ardi will be our main speaker tonight. He's a reader in the history of Africa and the African diaspora at Chichester University. And we'll be arguing tonight that recent military and other forms of intervention in Africa pose a new scramble for Africa, for resources, markets, and geopolitical influence. And Dr. Hakim's talk will be followed by a response by Dr. Kate Manzo. And Kate's a senior lecturer here in geography. Is a specialist on post-colonial theory and the politics of representing Africa. So Hakim will be talking for around 45 minutes, maybe slightly longer, slightly shorter. Then there'll be, I suppose, 10, 15 minutes for Kate's response, and that should leave plenty of time for questions and discussion. And after that, I think Tony will be saying some notes about Stop the War and their upcoming events. And just before I leave, practicalities, if there are people that are not familiar with the building, to get out at 7:15, you need to go out of the door that you came in and immediately left and down rather than into the foyer again. So with that, introduce our speaker.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It's only my second visit to Newcastle, so I'm very happy to be here. And thank you all for coming. I know it's a busy time for students and teachers this time of year, all busy with exams and marking and that kind of thing. So thank you all for coming. And as you heard in the introduction, the whole question of what I'm calling the New Scramble for Africa is a very topical question, we could say. And no doubt those recent events that people have been following in the news will inform our discussion today. So I'm going to just give some views. As you heard, I'm a historian, so I come at these things from a particular angle. And then hopefully we can have some discussion on some of the issues as they appear to present themselves today. I've got this rather misleading slide here as a historian. I think the last time I gave a similar presentation of this kind, Mali was in the news, or the invasion of Mali was in the news, to put it more correctly. And so I wanted to show something about the history of Mali, because very often when we speak about Africa, the way that Africa is presented in the media tends to be a very negative one, and its whole history is obliterated or distorted. There's all kinds of disinformation and so on. And so it's always important to put it into context. So this is perhaps the first, one of the first European representations of Africa from the 14th century. It relates particularly to West Africa, but probably more particularly to Mali 600 years ago and so on. Of course, the area of Africa which is in the news at the moment, the northeast of Nigeria, perhaps doesn't have such an illustrious or well-known history as the Empire of Ancient Mali, although the ancient empire of Kanem-Bornu was also in existence for what, some 800 years. But I couldn't find a picture of Kanem-Bornu to show, so I kept this one up just to remind me of that history. So that when we look at Africa today, we also have to take into account all the disinformation which is presented about it, its history, its circumstances, its politics, and so on. Okay, so with that introduction, let me say something about the question of the scramble. And having said that there's a new scramble, we need first to reconsider or consider the old scramble, which you'll be familiar with, of course, from the period of the last quarter of the 19th century, when figures like Cecil Rhodes wished to picture themselves astride Africa, were quite happy to be called imperialists, in fact revelled in that title, and wanted to carve out whole empires. In Rhodes' case, from the Cape to Cairo, and what did he say, the more of the world that we English inhabit, the better it is for the world, and this kind of thing. So they were, in some cases, unashamedly imperialist. And we know that that scramble at the end of the 19th century between all the major European powers for spheres of influence, for territory, marking out markets, and so on and so forth, was not exactly culminated in the infamous Conference of Berlin in 1884-1885, but certainly that is a useful date, an event for us, when literally the African continent was divided up between the major European powers. If we look at the map of Africa today, we still see, I'm sure the geographers will want to confirm this, we still see some of those boundaries that were simply drawn up, not by Africans, but by the European imperialist powers at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. So that was the nature of the scramble at the end of the 19th century. And here we can see the consequences. If we look at Africa round about 1914 and so on, we see this kind of division. The whole continent is parceled out between the big imperialist powers. And of course, that contention, that scramble for resources, for colonies, or for what were hoped would be resources of one sort or another, was part of a general contention in the world at that time, which by a pure coincidence we're commemorating this year, because of course that contention at the end of the 19th century between all the big powers culminated in the First World War, which you will be familiar with. Of course, you can look at various features here, strange anomalies which we could talk about. There are interesting ones like Gambia, you see here, is essentially a river, really, which Britain wanted to hang on to, even though the rest of it was enclosed by a French territory. Anyway, there are various anomalies one could go into. We haven't got time to go into all of that now. But this is the essence of this scramble and its result for Africa. And you'll see that only two areas were left unpartitioned, if you like, Liberia in the west and Ethiopia in the east. Although even there, they weren't entirely unpartitioned, but that's another story. Okay. So what were the consequences of this partition? Of course, various things were said at the time to explain, to justify, and so on. But if we just take the example of the Belgian colony of the Congo, quite important because Belgium, again, is in the news, as you're probably familiar, with the commemoration of the First World War, and the propaganda is Belgium's tiny little country in Europe, neutral, civilized, and of course that's why Britain went to war, to preserve its civilization, it was a wonderful place, and so on and so forth. And if we actually look at what Belgium represented at that time, or certainly what its king represented, here we have a very good illustration of it. Because Belgium, far from being a neutral, civilized place in the sense of what its government and governors did in the rest of the world, presided over these atrocities in the Belgian colony of the Congo, which in its early days was essentially the private domain of the King of Belgium. It's now estimated that under Leopold's jurisdiction, probably about, no one's quite sure, maybe half of the population were eliminated, about 10 million people, something along those lines. It became a big international scandal to such an extent that the Belgian government were forced to take over from their king and administer the colony and so on. Although, anyway, some of the crimes continued to be committed, as we know, even in the history of the Congo, right up until the 1960s, continued to be committed. But it's an illustration of, for Africa and Africans, what this scramble meant, what this partition meant during that period. Of course, the big powers didn't present it in that way. Didn't say it was in order to carry out atrocities or in order to grab resources and so on, at least many of them didn't. They presented it in a rather different way, as a civilizing mission of bringing Christianity, civilization, commerce to the dark continent. They presented it as the white man's burden, that here were Europeans not wanting to get involved in the affairs of another continent, but being forced to, in order to, as you can see, rid the world of ignorance, superstition, vice, and so on, to bring light, civilization, and so on. And Rudyard Kipling even wrote a poem about this white man's burden and so on. So this concept of the white man's burden, the civilizing mission, all this kind of thing, is quite important because, although we could say it's a 19th century phenomenon, it's not something which has been left in the 19th century. The concept is still very much with us today, only it's presented in slightly different terms. Okay, so then to come to the new scramble. Of course, there have been other scrambles for the resources of Africa between the 19th century and the late 20th century. The period before the Second World War, for example, was also a kind of mini-scramble with those countries that had their colonies confiscated by the victors in the First World War. Italy, Germany, demanded they should have new colonies and so on. And then in the period of the Cold War and so on. But we'll leave those aside and we'll talk about the new one. And by strange coincidence, we go back to the Congo. Because if we look at the Congo today, and even going back to the last, 20 years, we find again this new scramble for the resources of the Congo. We've all got our mobile phones and many of the resources which go into making those mobile phones come from this area of Central Africa, which is one of the biggest countries in Africa, one of the wealthiest in terms of its mineral resources, and also one of the poorest. in terms of the living standards of its inhabitants. This is a pictorial illustration of what has gone on there. And it's still going on, because the wars in the Congo continue. Initially, from the mid-1990s, when they first really broke out, they were kind of presented as, well, this some kind of African conflict, and so on and so forth. And they're still presented a little bit like that. There's Congo, and there's Rwanda, and there's Uganda, and various other countries are kind of involved, and no one's really clear what's going on. But actually, if you look at the most authoritative reports on what's happened in the Congo in the last 20 years, where, of course, another 10 million people have lost their lives. So under Leopold at the end of the 19th century, 10 million people died. Now under this new scramble, another 10 million or so died. I know this says 6 million, but this is a bit old. If you look at the authoritative reports on this scramble from the early part of this century, the UN analysis of what was going on in the Congo, it very clearly showed that behind various warring African countries were the big monopolies of Britain, France, Belgium, the US, and others. The British Aerospaces, everyone can name them all. You can go on the internet and find them and so on. So this scramble is real. It's documented. It leads to the loss of millions of people's lives because the resources of the Congo and other countries are necessary, are required by the big monopolies of Western countries, but also Eastern countries as well. Okay, so how does this manifest itself in the recent period? Well, we have the invasion of Libya, for example. How do we see the invasion of Libya? Well, of course, it's presented in various ways, that there's terrorists there and there's people who want democracy and all this kind of thing. Just as in the 19th century, the demands of the big powers for resources and so on were presented in terms of white man's burden, civilizing mission, Pax Britannicus, and so on and so forth, ending slavery. So in the 20th, 21st centuries, we have humanitarian intervention, bringing democracy, fighting against terrorism. But of course, behind all this are, what's the significance of Libya? Well, it's a major oil-producing country. It's one of the few countries around the Mediterranean not connected with NATO, that its leader was a key figure in African affairs, in financing and supporting the African Union, the Union of African States, was developing all kinds of initiatives for Africa, was opposed to AFRICOM and so on and so forth. And anyway, various justifications were given. The US, Britain, France, I was invaded, bombed the country, instituted regime change, assassinated or encouraged the assassination of the leader of the government, Libya, and so on and so forth. Of course, we now know some of the consequences of that intervention, which are complete chaos throughout the region, anarchy, and in fact the justification for more intervention, as I'll explain in a moment. They also have this idea of responsibility to protect. This is another version, you could say, of humanitarian intervention. I keep saying humanitarian intervention, which was the phrase that was developed by Prime Minister Blair, you remember, some years ago. He said Africa was a scar on the conscience of humanity. Never quite explain how the scar got there, but said this is another feature of the current scramble, that the big powers create problems and then they intervene allegedly that they're going to solve the problems that they themselves have created. So Blair developed the concept of humanitarian concern, and also right to responsibility to protect, which has no basis in international law at all. It's a complete concoction. Some powerful countries have the right to allegedly protect civilians who are being threatened by their own governments and this kind of thing. In fact, the senior foreign policy advisor for Blair, Robert Cooper, was much more open, because he said what we need is a new kind of imperialism. We need intervention. They had this whole idea of rogue states, fragile states, that we have to intervene and stuff. So all these things are justifications for intervention in order to establish positions of power and control over resources, or over areas of strategic interest as well, or the ability to intervene, and so on. So again, we can go into that in more detail. Okay, so then after Libya, of course, the usefulness of intervention in Libya, you could say one of the aims of it was to, anyway, secure an important strategic area, to have more influence over the oil resources of the country and various other things, as I've explained. But it then created this chaos, particularly in the southern part of Libya and across the whole Sahel region, you know, the shore of the Sahara, the whole Saharan region, where further justification was given for more intervention. And the key area there, another strategic area, was Mali, which sits in a very important position, obviously close to Niger and other regions, which are, amongst other things, there's uranium, there's oil, there are other resources, of course, and it's an important strategically. And here the justification given was that, you could say, almost exactly the same forces that the NATO countries had supported in Libya, they now said were creating problems in Mali and operating with other local forces and so on and so forth. And so there needed to be intervention. What was intriguing about that was that it was precisely in an area where the US had established its, Trans-Saharan Anti-Terrorism Initiative for 10 years. So Mali was actually the headquarters of the US anti-terrorism initiative, in fact, two anti-terrorism initiatives in that part of Africa, and surprisingly, exactly in the area where they'd had an initiative for 10 years, even trained elements in the army of Mali and so on, this was exactly the place where these terrorists suddenly appeared. And it became necessary for further intervention and so on. If you look more recently, you'll see that, okay, the French army intervened with British, US and other support. They're still there. There's still a problem. This week they announced that there was such a problem in Mali that they were now going to extend their mission, not only in Mali, but in Chad, in Niger, and also in Burkina Faso, that they would establish a military presence of some 3,000 troops and also establish a new base in Côte d'Ivoire. So this whole region would come under, say, French military occupation, but you could say that. And the justification, they say, well, the chaos in Libya has created a safe haven for so-called terrorists, therefore we need to step up our military activity in the region. So one form of intervention, as I say, leads to increasing intervention or further intervention. But behind it and behind this alleged anti-terrorist activity, the big powers are jostling for position, for influence, and for greater control over the resources and also over the governments of these particular parts of Africa. Okay, well, this is, anyway, this just illustrates the point I've just made. And as I say, they're now, the French are now saying that they're going to move right across this region. Now, the fact that oil deposits have been found right across this region, Niger, Chad, and so on, is purely coincidental, I'm sure, and other deposits of minerals and so on. But you can see it's a very important area. Of course, it's also adjacent to other important economic strategic areas, Algeria and also Mauritania. Of course, Niger already has both French and American presence. The Americans have their drone base there, where they're watching everything that's going on, unable to find Boko Haram and 300 young women. But anyway, they have a spy base there, which has been operational for some time. Okay. Then, you remember that one? Then another feature of the, you could say, creating public opinion for intervention today is that we have these various rather interesting campaigns, very often on social media. This one you'll remember, which was related to the hunt for Joseph Kony, or alleged hunt, which coincided with the legislation passed in the US on US intervention in Uganda, and also to some extent Central African Republic as well, and burst on the scene in 2012, and then there were various exposures of what it was all about, and it disappeared and so on. Because it had served its purpose. The law had been passed, the troops had been sent, so on. Of course, one of the features that we also have to bear in mind is that behind the activities of the, or connected with the activities of the NATO powers, is AFRICOM, which is active throughout the continent. It's allegedly, the US African command mechanism, we could say, allegedly to train the armies of Africa and so on and so forth. But of course, in fact, its main aim is to, according to its own description of what it's about, is to make sure that the resources which the US needs continue to flow to the US and so on. Of course, as I'll explain later, many people argue that it was actually set up not just to do that, but particularly as a weapon, a means of combating particularly the influence of China in Africa. And I'm going to talk about the influence of China in Africa in a moment. But it's important to remember that AFRICOM is extremely active. It's perhaps not coincidental that a major exercise has just concluded, just off the coast of Nigeria, involving, I can't remember now, I think it's 11 different nations. Rather interesting naval exercise, particularly bearing in mind some of the participants. So the Brazilian Navy were involved, for example. The Navy of Turkey were involved. The German Navy were involved. Germany not noted for its Navy, of course, in recent times. But one of their first overseas missions, I think, recently, or big overseas missions, was taking part in this AFRICOM exercise, which was based just off the coast of Nigeria. But there are many of these joint exercises throughout Africa with many, in fact, most African countries. And it's a further way in which the US extends its influence, both in terms of actually having troops on the ground, its influence over various African governments, and its general presence on the continent. Okay, well, anyway, people are now familiar with the whole Bring Back Our Girls campaign, especially now that David Cameron has embraced it. Most people's eyebrows should have been raised if they weren't raised before. This is one of the pictures which was used for the campaign. I was rather intrigued by this picture because it was very widespread. There was very widespread use of it. It's now turned out that the young woman pictured in it has nothing to do with Nigeria at all. Didn't give her permission for the picture to be used. Comes from somewhere, actually comes from Guinea. It's a picture of her waiting, you know, waiting for her teacher and so on. Anyway, that's not obviously the key issue about this whole campaign. And we can perhaps go into it in more detail in the discussion. But the interesting thing about the campaign is that it has some features which make it similar to the Kony campaign. Of course, the crime which has been committed in northeastern Nigeria is obviously clearly very different to the circumstances there. But it's a campaign which has spread very widely through social media in a very short time, has generated a lot of concern internationally. But there are various curious things about what's going on in Nigeria. But the upshot of it is that it's provided a further excuse for the intervention of the big powers, particularly Britain and the US. I think France is also ready to intervene. And because of the nature of Boko Haram itself, which of course has, like all these so-called terrorist organizations in Africa, has very strange and shady connections, antecedents, and so on. The justification has been presented for further military intervention in an area which, even in Borno state itself, and in fact across that whole region of Nigeria, of course there are massive unexplored oil fields, as there are in that whole region of West Africa. So we can go into it in more detail exactly what's going on. But to me it's reminiscent, as I say, of past attempts to create the conditions for public opinion, to give some, or to be less concerned, shall we say, about the intervention of governments of NATO in this particular region. And of course in Nigeria, a region in which Chinese influence, the influence of China economically, is very, very high. And as you may know, there was some question whether Nigeria was going to keep its reserve currency in dollar or in yuan or what. And there are massive investments, only the last 2 weeks, massive investments by the government of China in Nigeria. So we can look at that in more detail maybe later. So what lies then behind this, what I'm saying is a scramble? Or you could say, why is Africa so important at this particular time? Well, there's some interesting stats. Again, I don't want, as a historian, I don't want to go into all these things too much detail. But one thing which is interesting is that the fact that Africa's economies, or many African countries' economies, are growing very, very rapidly. And if we look at these, are like the top 10 fastest growing economies, and you'll see that many of them are African economies, even in the projections here. So Africa is growing. It's increasingly wealthy in general terms, in terms of its resources. It's important also in terms of its population growth. Again, I know the geographers will know much more about this than I do, but of course it's predicted that Africa's population will grow much more quickly in the next few years than the population of other continents. So in terms of a market, it's increasingly important. And it's also predicted that those who have purchasing power, that segment of the population, which is still quite small, will grow quite markedly over the next few years. So Africa as a market and Africa as an area of economic development is becoming increasingly important and will become increasingly important over the next few years. The second is, again you can have a look at this, it's just really makes a similar point. You can see that if Africa was a country, because people like Gaddafi and others talked about United States of Africa. That may be a way off yet, but anyway, if we just hang on to that concept of Africa as one economy, it would be roughly the same as you see there to somewhere like Russia or India, or the position that Russia and India had 3 years ago. Africa will reach that position in wherever we are 3 years' time. So as a continent, it's an even bigger perspective, power, we could say, economic powerhouse. Of course, it doesn't work in that way, but you see what I mean. Potentially, it's extremely important. And then we have the question of trade. And this just compares the US and China. And again, the key thing about it, you'll see that China has overtaken the US. Or if you like, that the two are very much in contention as to which will dominate the African continent in terms of trade, because the US started out stronger, but China has risen rapidly, especially in the last 10 years. And in fact, the growth of China's trade with Africa has, I think it's gone up 30%, 30 times or something in the last 10 years. Okay, well, this is a similar kind of pictorial representation. This is going back a few years. Again, you can see the contention there. The other thing is you'll see essentially a drop also, a decline in US exports, or Africa's exports to the US, and a stark rise in exports to China. And similarly here, exports from the US and China to Africa. Well, again, you can see that China is strong, shall we say, in that area. And again, this is a slightly older graphic. But it's just to make the point about the contention in which I'm talking about. If we take the example of Nigeria as one illustration, as you can see up there, I just think in the recent few weeks, there's been the announcement of, I think Chinese company investing $10 billion in a new oil field in Nigeria. I think something like $30 billion in a new railway line. Anyway, you can go on and on and on and on. They've extended another, I can't remember how many billion in credits to Nigeria and so on. So the economic activity of China, as well as the other BRICS, and I'll come on to the BRICS in a moment, is very, very strong. And here we have the BRICS. Again, this is a slightly old graphic, as you can see, so it's a little bit out of date. But it illustrates, I think, the point that the BRICS are increasing. We look at 2000 and we look at 2009, EU's going down, BRICS going up, emerging economies going up, China going up, US going down and so on. I mean, it's without going into it in great detail. Again, it's to show the contention which is going on between these different economies and economic blocks. Okay, so that is the contention. Of course, from the point of view of China, it's principally, at the moment anyway, in economic terms. It's loans, it's credits, it's assistance with the building of infrastructure, it's purchasing of oil, it's building oil refineries, it's investing in manufacturing, it's in trade, and so on. With the former big powers, it's much less of that. And you could say the question is, I think David Cameron calls it the Great Game. Let's call it the Great Game? Yes. In this contention between the old powers and China and the BRICS, the new powers, how are the old powers to regain their former glory, as it were? And what I would suggest is that part of that in Africa is finding other ways of intervening, other forms of intervention, political intervention and also military intervention. And also, of course, the destabilization of countries, which we see in Sudan, Congo, Nigeria, Mali, Libya, and elsewhere. And the various forms of humanitarian intervention, of course, as well. Okay, so what about the peoples of Africa? Because that's a factor, you could say, which is often maybe left out of the equation, what is going on. Well, again, there in recent years we've seen very obvious examples of, if you like, the activities of people in Africa taking things into their own hands. In particular, the revolutionary events that occurred in North Africa, particularly in Egypt, Tunisia, which for some reason people spoke of as the Arab Spring, even though these things occurred in Africa. Nobody called them the African Spring. Not sure why that was. Of course, there have been some reverses, particularly in Egypt. But nevertheless, the people of these countries demonstrated, of course, that they were a factor, perhaps the most important factor in deciding what the future of the of Africa would be and the future of their particular countries. They also demonstrated very often that they rejected the neoliberal prescription for Africa, whether in the form of the IMF, the World Bank, or the various proxy governments. Of course, in Egypt, the government, as you know, was supported by whatever it was, $2 billion from the US every year, with British support, with French support, and so on. So that was all rejected, and people wanted an alternative. At the moment, they haven't got that alternative yet, because the military have managed to reassert their position. Of course, the greatest supporter of the military in Egypt is who? Well, yes, the US. I was thinking of Tony Blair, actually. Tony Blair says, yes, we're all for revolution, and we must support the military. So anyway. Okay, so Egypt would be a very good example of that struggle. Then, of course, we have the recent, or not too recent, events in South Africa. Of course, I know there are elections at the moment, but the struggle of the miners at Marikana, but also elsewhere, demonstrating again their opposition to the neoliberal prescriptions, we can say, which are in place in that country. But more importantly, perhaps demonstrating they wish to be a factor in deciding the direction of that country, that they have to be central, they have to be considered, even though, generally speaking, they may not be considered. And then we have, just to give another example, this is from Nigeria. Remember, just a couple of years ago, there was a general strike in Nigeria too, where the working people again rose up against austerity, against cuts in subsidies, against the imposition of IMF, and so on. And yes, made their views known to the world. So you could argue that, and Egypt's a very good example here, that the fear of the people of African countries taking things into their own hands also exercises the minds of the big powers. It is not coincidental that Tony Blair is the biggest supporter of the military rule in Egypt. That after the first upsurge of the Egyptian revolution, again the big powers rushed to Cairo, said they supported revolution, and all that kind of thing. In other words, tried to intervene as quickly as they could. Of course, in Tunisia, you remember the French government supporting the regime of Ben Ali, even when the revolutionary events were unfolding and so on. So this concern as well, the concern about the role of the working people of Africa, also, you could say, is a factor, I would argue, in the intervention of the big powers, in the support for dictatorial reactionary governments, in support for, in some cases, military rule, and so on. So that's something that we also have to take into account in this whole scramble and contention for Africa's resources, Africa's markets, and so on. Okay. Then, lastly, there is the question of us. Because very often that we're, those of us in Britain, we're left out of this equation when events in Africa or events in Syria or events in Iraq or some other place are being discussed. You know, what is our role, or how do we express our concern, and so on. You could say even in, anyway, those who are most concerned about these things, there's sometimes, you know, elements of confusion and so on about what we should be most concerned about, and so on. And with the disinformation which is presented about Africa and other events in the world, it's not difficult to see why this is the case. But I think, my view is, I think that we should be concerned in particular about what our government is doing. I say our in inverted commas. I know it's not our government in the sense that it's answerable to us or that we even voted for it, or but it's the government of our country, let's say. that we should be concerned how it acts internationally. What it's doing in Libya, what it's doing in Nigeria, what it's doing in Somalia, what it's doing in Mali. I think in considering what action or what kind of government we want. Do we want a government that intervenes all over the world, which supports dubious elements in Syria or wherever it might be, or in Libya or elsewhere, which seems to be connected with unrest and instability all around the world, which intervenes in countries under various guises, and the situation becomes much worse than before it intervened along with its allies and so on. So I think in the case of Africa, again, that's something for us to consider. You know, in the last few years, we've seen various governments, have been Labour, Conservative, Liberal, and so on and so forth. And they've all intervened in similar ways, under different guises. And the situation for the majority of people in Africa has not improved. Earlier when I spoke about Africa developing, that's a slightly misleading, perhaps, way of looking at it. If we take a country like Nigeria, it now has the biggest economy in Africa, which is worth whatever it is, 350 billion or something. But it's the fourth, you know, largest oil producer in the world and so on. It exports natural gas and various other things. But for the majority of people in Nigeria, 85 to 90% of people exist on less than $2 a day. And that is because, not because the governments of Britain and other powerful countries haven't intervened enough, but because they've intervened too much. Or because the big monopolies of Britain, the Shells and others, have intervened too much. Or because too much aid has been given. I know there's a lot of disinformation about aid and so on, that it's allegedly to aid people in Africa, but I think most people understand it's to aid, it's a subsidy to the big monopolies here and so on. It's a way of tying those countries to the interests of the rich and powerful here. And one can give numerous examples to illustrate that. So there's that intervention which goes on, economic intervention, political intervention, but now also military intervention and so on. So I think we need to be concerned about those things. We need to be concerned about the activities of British monopolies or British-based multinationals, as well as the intervention and interference of the government and so on. So again, we can discuss what we can do, what that means. But I think, as I say, it's in the context of this scramble which is going on for the resources of Africa. So that's not too long. Sorry, a bit over time. Sorry about that. So I'm going to finish there. And as I say, hopefully in a few minutes we can discuss all of those issues. So thank you very much.